Welcome to this deep dive into the cerebral cortex. We're going to be digging into your sources today, specifically what Stop, Do, Cognity, Wistiki, Chapter A14, the one on the cortex and information in the brain.
That's right. And our goal really is to get to the heart of how your cortex works, you know, its structure, how it adapts, which is amazing. And well, what happens when things don't quite go right?
Yeah, hopefully giving you a much clearer picture of how your brain actually, well, creates your reality.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's kick things off. The text starts by outlining three main jobs for the cortex. Analyzing sensory input.
All that information coming in.
Controlling movement, obviously, and then the higher level stuff like planning, thinking, even analyzing emotions.
Right, but the source we're focusing on really zooms in on those first two. Sensory analysis and motor control. That's the main thrust.
Okay, so how we make sense of the world and how we move through it.
Pretty much. And the way it breaks down sensory processing is, well, it's fascinating. It's a multi-stage system.
Multi-stage. Intriguing. Walk me through that. How does that work? Taking in information.
Okay. So it all begins in the primary sensory areas. Think of them as the brain's first receivers.
Right.
They get the basic raw data directly from the thalamus, you know, the brain's big relay station. So at this level, the brain just registers that something happened, where on the body it happened, and like what kind of receptor got triggered.
So really basic stuff, hot or cold, sharp pain or dull ache, loud or soft sound, that kind of thing.
Exactly. The absolute fundamentals, the basic what and where.
Got it. So stage one, initial registration, then what?
Then that info gets passed along to what are called the secondary projection association areas.
Okay.
This is where the brain starts to figure out what that sensation actually means.
Ah, interpretation.
Right. So it's not just pressure on your left foot anymore. Now it's, is this just the floor? Or is something heavy pressing down, maybe causing pain? It's about understanding the significance. And things like figuring out the shape of something you're touching or which way something's moving. That requires combining signals from lots of nearby receptors at this secondary stage.
Right, building a slightly richer picture. Moving from just a signal to, like, an initial understanding.
Precisely. And then you get to the tertiary association areas. This is where the really complex stuff happens.
Where it all comes together.
Exactly. Integrating information from different senses. This is how we form those complete perceptions of the world. You know, the images we hold in our mind, our imaginations.
Wow.
And the text gives this great example with macaque monkeys. Over half their cortex is dedicated just to vision.
50%.
Yeah.
Just for seeing.
Yeah. While only a small fraction handles touch, and even less for hearing, it really shows how crucial different senses are for different species and how brain resources get allocated.
It makes you think about our own senses, doesn't it? What our allocation looks like.
It really does. Yeah. And all this complex analysis happens in the neocortex. That's the part the source links to those higher cognitive functions.
Mm-hmm. The new bark. Where is that located generally? What's the layout?
So the neocortex, it's the most recently evolved part. The text explains that the back and side parts, posterior and lateral, are heavily involved in sensory analysis, like we've been talking about.
Okay.
Then as you move forward, you get the frontal part, and right at the very front, the prefrontal cortex.
The executive control center.
You could say that.
Yeah.
Crucial for planning, working memory, that mental scratch pad, and sending the commands down to the motor cortex to actually make us move.
That makes sense. Sensing at the back, planning and acting at the front. The numbers the source gives are just staggering, though. 14 to 18 billion neurons in the neocortex. And 60 billion glial cells.
It's mind-boggling, isn't it? And while that's maybe only a fifth of the brain's total neurons, these neocortical ones are generally larger, with incredibly complex connections.
And it's those connections, the white matter, that make it so big, right? Like 80% of the brain's volume.
Exactly. It's the sheer volume of connections, the connectome, the brain's wiring diagram that takes up so much space and is so critical for everything the cortex does.
And it's not just a flat sheet. It's all folded up. You mentioned it's like a pizza squished into a box.
Ah, yeah, that's a good way to picture it. The thickness varies a bit, you know, 1.5 millimeters in some visual spots, up to maybe 4.5 in motor areas. But if you enfolded one hemisphere, it'd be about the size of a medium pizza, around 1,000 square centimeters.
That's incredible. All that surface area packed in.
It's how the brain maximizes its processing power within the skull. That fractal dimension, around 2.8, just shows how intensely folded it is.
And it has layers, right? the six layers of the isocortex and the older allocortex with three.
Yes. Most of the cortex is that six-layered isocortex, and each layer has sort of specialized roles. Receiving input, sending output, connecting to other cortical areas or the thalamus.
So layers 2 to 4 mostly receive info, and layers 2, 3, 5, 6 mostly send it out. Something like that.
Broadly speaking, yes. Layer 1 is mostly connections, fewer cell bodies.
And within those layers, there's that vertical structure too, mini columns and macro columns.
Right. Another key principle, you've got these dense vertical connections, sparser horizontal ones. It creates functional columns. Mini columns are tiny, maybe 80, 120 neurons packed together.
Especially in visual areas, it says.
Yeah. And macro columns are much bigger bundles, tens or hundreds of thousands of neurons, like 70 to 1,000 mini columns bundled together.
The rat whisker example helps picture that. Each whisker gets its own column.
Exactly, like little dedicated processing units for each whisker's vibration.
So tiny microprocessors all network together.
That's a great analogy. And connecting them all is the white matter again, those long axons, 3 billion of them, 150,000 kilometers total length.
Mind-blowing numbers. And the corpus callosum connecting the hemispheres, that alone is 200 million axons.
Huge communication highway. And it's insulated with myelin, which speeds things up.
Right, the insulation. Mm-hmm. And those nodes of Ranvier boosting the signal allow signals to travel about 10 meters per second.
Around that, yeah, for the long connections. But it varies. Like, motor neurons and sharp pain signals are faster than some of the duller pain signals.
Interesting. And the white matter peaks around age 40, along with reaction times.
That's what the research suggests, yeah. Seems to be linked.
Now, mapping the brain. We hear about Brodmann areas. That's an old system, right?
Very influential, though, from 1909. Brodmann looked at the cell structures, the cytoarchitecture, under a microscope and identified 52 distinct regions. It's still a foundational map.
But now we have newer maps, like from the Human Connectome Project.
Exactly. Using modern imaging, they mapped out 180 areas per hemisphere in 2016, based more on connectivity patterns. It gives a more dynamic picture.
And everyone's map is slightly different. The thickness and size of regions varies.
Absolutely. Significant individual variation.
It's humbling. The source also contrasts the cortex with the cerebellum.
Right. The cerebellum has way more neurons, 80% of the brain's total, but it's much smaller, maybe 10% of the volume. Denser, smaller neurons.
And the subcortical bits are tiny, neuron-wise, but still vital.
Critically important for all sorts of basic functions, yeah.
Which brings us to connectomics, mapping all those connections.
Right, using techniques like DTI diffusion tensor imaging.
That tracks water movement along axons.
Yeah, basically visualizes the wiring. We can see the big bundles, identify the major hubs, those super-connected areas like parts of the frontal and parietal cortex, hippocampus, thalamus.
And functional connectivity looks at which areas work together.
Yeah.
Based on synchronized activity.
Exactly. It's crucial to distinguish structural connections, the physical wires, from functional connections. How those wires are actually used for different tasks, like roads versus traffic flow.
That makes sense. The network is incredibly dynamic.
Totally. You've got all these neuron types, projection neurons sending signals far away, local interneurons chatting nearby, commissural ones crossing hemispheres, sensory ones bringing info in, motor ones sending commands out.
Specific pathways, non-specific ones.
Yeah.
It sounds incredibly complex.
It is, microscopically. But the amazing thing is, the overall connection pattern, the general microcircuit design, seems pretty similar across different cortical areas. They use these rhythmic oscillations, brain waves, to process things.
And just to recap the big picture, 2 hemispheres, 5 lobes, plus the limbic one tucked inside, and all those folds, gyri and sulci.
That's the basic landscape, the stage where all this happens.
Okay, so it's structured, connected, but not fixed, right? Neuroplasticity.
The brain can change.
Absolutely fundamental. The cortex is remarkably adaptable. Sensory substitution is one example. Other senses compensating for a lost one.
Like in stroke recovery, too. Other areas taking over.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Though the source rightly notes recovery is often slow and maybe incomplete. But the key idea is that the cortex isn't just reacting. It's performing specific types of information processing. And that processing capacity can be reshaped by experience. It's about the underlying computation, not just fixed wires. Now, the source asks this big question. Is the cortex absolutely essential, like for any awareness?
It's a profound question. Well, complete anencephaly, basically. no cortex or much else isn't compatible with life.
Right.
But then there's hydranencephaly, where most of the cortex is missing, just fluid-filled sacs. And remarkably, some individuals can survive with care and show some basic awareness, turning to sounds, basic emotions.
Really? Without a cortex?
It suggests subcortical structures, brainstem, limbic system can support some very basic functions, reflexes, maybe rudimentary awareness, but no self-reflection, complex perception, planning, none of that.
And animals without a cortex, rodents, cats.
Studies showed they can behave surprisingly normally with some subtle deficits, but yeah, it complicates the picture.
It really does. Okay, let's shift to mapping functions. Phrenology comes up. That sounds dated.
Dated is putting it mildly. Yeah, early 19th century, Gall and Spurzheim, feeling skull bumps to read personality traits.
Like 37 different organs for things like cautiousness or humor.
Yeah, pretty much. It was an early attempt to link brain and function. And there's that funny anecdote about stimulating the supposed humor area actually causing laughter. But scientifically, it's pseudoscience.
Why exactly? What makes it invalid?
Well, fundamentally, the skull shape just doesn't map onto the brain surface beneath. You've got the protective layers, the fluid. The bumps on your head don't tell you about the cortex folds or thickness underneath.
Right. Bad proxy.
Yeah.
So phrenology was a dead end, but the idea of localization wasn't entirely wrong. The source talks about afferent and efferent projections, inputs and outputs of the cortex.
Yeah. The basic wiring. Afferent means incoming signals from other areas in the same hemisphere, association fibers, the opposite hemisphere, commissural fibers like via the corpus callosum, the thalamus relaying sensory info, brainstem for arousal.
And efferent is outgoing.
Right. Signals going out from the cortex. Back to other cortical areas, down to the striatum for motor control, brainstem, cranial nerves, spinal cord to control muscles.
And this wiring allows for really nuanced control, like facial expressions. The difference between a real smile and a fake one.
Perfect example. Different muscle groups, slightly different control pathways. Subcortical structures handle more automatic emotional expressions, while the motor cortex gives us that voluntary control for, say, a polite smile. That's why a genuine smile involves the eyes. It's harder to fake.
Fascinating. Okay, so how does the cortex process info? Three mechanisms mentioned. Topographical mapping, population coding, associative mechanisms. Let's start with topographical maps.
Right. Topographical mapping is super fundamental. It's basically creating a map of the sensory world onto the cortex surface.
Like points on your skin map to adjacent points in the brain.
Exactly. It preserves the spatial relationships, helps with initial analysis, makes processing efficient. We see these maps for different senses, even in motor areas and subcortical structures too, like the superior colliculi.
So mini maps of our senses on the brain surface. And these are part of those larger networks, the connectome.
Precisely. They're embedded in the structural wiring. But the functional connections, how these maps and areas actually talk to each other for specific tasks, that's highly dynamic.
Changes based on what we're doing, our mood, alertness.
All of that, which is why distinguishing structural versus functional connectivity is so important, and why maybe some psychiatric issues might relate more to functional network problems, while neurological ones often involve structural damage. It's a rough distinction, but useful.
And these maps exist for both sensory input and motor output with similar mechanisms.
Seems that way, yes. Let's dive into the somatosensory maps first. Wilder Penfield's work comes up.
Ah, the homunculus guy, stimulating the brain during surgery.
That's him, pioneering work. He mapped out which cortical areas corresponded to sensations in different body parts, and the result is that famous distorted homunculus figure.
With the huge hands and lips.
Right, because the amount of cortical space dedicated to a body part reflects its sensory importance, its sensitivity. Huge areas for human hands and language parts. Massive areas for rodent whiskers. It reflects the species' needs.
So the primary somatosensory cortex, SI, that's where this mapping happens first, behind the central sulcus.
Correct. In the parietal lobe, right behind that main groove, it gets touch, pain, temperature, vibration, proprioception, body position sense, all relayed via the thalamus.
Different neurons for different feelings. Fast versus slow pain fibers.
Exactly. And different nuclei in the thalamus handle different inputs, like VPL and VPM. There are even mechanisms in the spinal cord to modulate pain, like how rubbing helps.
And SI is right next to the motor cortex, MI, for quick reflexes.
Yep. Allows for very fast sensorimotor loops, like pulling your hand away from heat. Most of the body map is contralateral, opposite side control, but face and tongue have some ipsilateral, same side representation, too.
And if SI is damaged, loss of sensation, but maybe pain temperature come back via the thalamus.
Potentially, yes. Some basic sensation might be processed subcortically.
SI also has that columnar structure right, with different Brodmann areas inside it doing slightly different jobs, like 3A for movement sense, 3B for touch.
That's right. Area 2 and 3A focus more on proprioception, 3B on touch, Area 1 integrates things more. Again, cortical real estate is proportional to the importance of the information for discrimination.
Now, plasticity again. The idea these maps were fixed in adults, that changed, didn't it? Bakirita, Mersenek, Taub.
Big time. Their work showed the adult brain is much more plastic than previously thought. Selfishly after injury, like stroke, Taub's constraint-induced movement therapy is a key example.
Forcing the use of the weaker limb rewires the brain.
It can promote significant reorganization in both sensory and motor cortex, yeah. It shows the potential for rehabilitation. The text also nods to the ethical complexities, like the Silver Spring Monkeys case related to some of Taub's early work.
Right. But the core idea of neuroplasticity is huge, like learning to tell your toes apart by touch, or how wearing shoes affects that.
Exactly. Experience shapes these maps. Sensory deprivation changes them. Extra stimulation changes them. Nerve damage and repair changes them. Learning new skills changes them. Our ability to discriminate sensations is key for conscious perception.
But there's that balance, right? The plasticity stability dilemma, needing to learn, but also needing a stable worldview.
Precisely. You need flexibility to adapt, but stability to not forget everything or have your world constantly shifting chaotically. It's a trade-off at every level, synapses, brain networks, even society.
So topographical maps are for detailed analysis and guiding actions. What of the secondary somatosensory cortex, SII?
SII is tucked deeper, near the lateral sulcus and insula. Maybe includes parts of the inferior parietal lobule, too.
Hmm.
Unlike SI, it gets input from both sides of the body, plus SI thalamus corpus callosum.
More integrated. Important for tactile learning, maybe. Transferring skills between hands.
That's the thinking, yes. Higher-level tactile processing.
And damage there causes weird things, like pain, asymbolia, feeling pain but not suffering from it.
Exactly. Or sometimes the opposite. Chronic burning pain, causalgia. It highlights the dissociation between sensing pain and the emotional response. Congenital analgesia, being born unable to feel pain, also links to this system, often due to specific gene mutations affecting nerve function.
Damasio's cases showed that too, right? Pain without suffering after surgery in related areas.
Yes, involving the cingulate, gyrus, and insula, which are heavily interconnected with SII. And many painkillers seem to work partly by affecting the anterior cingulate.
It's wild how sensation and emotion can be separated. Referred pain, delayed pain, also mentioned.
Just more examples of the complexity. SII is also thought to be involved in the emotional feel of touch. And basic pain can trigger reflexes before the cortex fully processes it.
Okay, then there's the supplementary somatosensory area, SSA, superior parietal lobule.
Right. Involved in even more complex stuff. Stereognosis, recognizing objects purely by touch, shape, texture, weight, needs learning, integration with vision often.
And dermalexia, recognizing shapes drawn on the skin.
Also attributed to SSA.
It really seems sensory and motor are tangled up. Sensory cortex has motor neurons, motor cortex has sensory ones.
Definitely interconnected. Helps coordinate perception and action smoothly. We sense the external world, exterception, and our internal state, interoception.
And agnosia is when you can't recognize sensory info. Stereognosia is specifically for touch.
Right. Often a higher-level processing problem in the parietal lobe.
Like optic ataxia, seeing an object fine but being unable to reach for it properly.
Yes, often linked to damage in the LIP area of the parietal cortex. That area maps objects for action, coordinates eye-body movements, integrates spatial info with planning and attention. The link between SI and SSA helps connect vision and touch for guiding actions.
What about losing proprioception? Body blindness. Oliver Sacks's disembodied woman.
A devastating loss. Without that sense of body position, movement becomes incredibly hard, needs constant visual checking. But Ian Waterman's case showed vision can compensate somewhat via parietal SI connections, though it takes immense effort and retraining.
And weird stimulation can cause odd sensations, like falling. Sensory substitution can help.
Yes. Tongue displays providing feedback, for instance. Even simple vibration can create illusions of movement.
Which leads us to phantom limbs. Feeling a limb that isn't there.
Super common after amputation. 60-80% experience it. Feels very real pain. Temperature, itch, movement. The main theory is cortical reorganization.
The bit of cortex for the missing limb gets taken over by neighbors. Unmasking weak connections.
That's the idea. Less common in paraplegia, interestingly. And itch and pain use different pathways. Scratching might block itch signals by activating pain pathways in the spinal cord.
Phantom pain can be awful, though. What causes it? How is it treated?
It can be severe and long-lasting for some. It can happen after amputation, spinal injury, even congenital limb issues. That case of phantom finger movement in someone born without it suggests our basic body map is partly genetic.
Ramachandran's work is key here. Ingrown phantom fingernails.
Yeah, he explored it extensively. Proposed pain could come from stimulation of adjacent cortical areas or spontaneous firing in the reorganized zone. His mirror box therapy is famous.
Watching the reflection of the good limb tricks the brain.
It can help remap the cortex and reduce pain for some, yes. The text also briefly mentions the idea of innate body image differences, potentially relating to phantom experiences in transgender individuals, though that's complex and needs more research.
The brain creating realities. The rubber hand illusion. Full body illusions.
Classic experiments by Ersin, Blank, others, show how easily our sense of body ownership is shaped by vision and touch. You can feel a rubber hand is yours. Stimulating the TPJ can even induce out-of-body experiences.
Wow. Supernumerary phantoms, extra limbs. The Pinocchio illusion knows growing.
Stranger still, low-frequency rhythms in the retrosolenial cortex seem linked to these dissociative states.
Then there's the opposite. Unwanted limbs, body dysmorphia, even pedonophilia, wanting a healthy limb removed.
Difficult conditions. A profound disconnect from one's own body. Synesthesia is our general internal body sense. Phantoms are a type of sensory hallucination. Others exist too, like weird internal sensations. All interpretations by the brain.
Could be weird SII amygdala links causing bad feelings, maybe. Hard to treat.
That's one hypothesis. Maybe pleasant sensory stimulation could counter it. It's speculative.
The parietal cortex builds these spatial maps. Egocentric, allocentric,
yeah.
And body image develops until our early 20s.
Seems to stabilize around 23, yeah. And other areas like cerebellum, NRT, superior colliculi also have somatosensory maps. Computational models show proprioception is key for predicting movement, recognizing objects, controlling the body.
And attention filters all this, right?
Yeah.
Thalamus is the gatekeeper, RTN modulating input based on relevance.
Crucial roles. Finally, ASMR, that tingling from whispers, etc., subjective, but has physiological links. Different from frisson, the musical chills.
Okay, phew. Sensory processing is incredibly complex. Let's switch to motor control. 640 muscles, complex coordination needed.
Absolutely. Even simple movements are feats of engineering. Main pathways, corticospinal and the loop involving cerebellum, thalamus, cortex. Spinal reflexes handle basic stuff.
But intentional movement needs integration. Proprioception, vision, balance, and practice makes things automatic muscle memory.
Exactly. Control shifts to more subconscious levels.
Three main motor areas, MI, MII, SMA, primary motor, premotor, supplementary motor.
Right. MI area 4 is just ahead of the central sulcus. MII, premotor, and SMA, supplementary, are in area 6, just in front of MI. MI has the motor homunculus map.
Like the sensory one, but for controlling muscles, stimulation causes precise movements.
Very precise. Single muscles sometimes. Short latency, 60, 80 meters. But crucially, no feeling of wanting to move when stimulated. Again, mostly contralateral control, but face head have bilateral input. MI gets input from sensory cortex, thalamus via cerebellum, and MII.
SMA and MII, more complex roles.
SMA helps organize movement sequences, especially using both hands or memory-guided moves. Partial map, too. MII is bigger, handles more complex tasks. Lateral part guides actions based on sensory input.
Like visual motor or audio motor coordination.
Yes, MII is active there. Stimulation causes more complex stereotyped movements. Ventrolateral part involved in goal-directed actions like grasping. Damage to MII can cause apraxia difficulty with learned complex movements.
So, MISMA plan and sequence. MI executes. Now, population coding for movement. How does that work?
It's fundamental. Single motor neurons fire most for a specific preferred direction, less for similar ones. The overall movement direction comes from summing up the activity of a whole population, hundreds, thousands of neurons.
Like the brain averaging the votes of many neurons.
Exactly. Strongest in MI columns. Decisions by population average, not single neurons. Found in MI, MII, SMA, cerebellum, allows precise control, robustness. Complex moves are built from these basic directional signals.
Like that finger tapping example. Synchronized neurons shifting patterns with the metronome.
Yeah, and that leg circling hand drawing 6 demo shows how motor programs interfere.
Simple things showing complex coordination. The text also mentions motor therapies, neurogenesis from movement, Feldenkrais.
Yes, evidence suggests movement stimulates brain health, even new cell growth, somatic education. Feldenkrais focuses on awareness of movement. And just brisk walking has huge benefits: mood, depression risk, blood flow, memory, creativity.
And language syntax, using similar brain areas as motor control, like the basal ganglia.
Intriguing parallel, yeah. Suggests common mechanisms for sequencing.
Also mentions gesture, sign language.
Right. Darker skin may be enhancing gesture visibility. Chimps using gestures. Sign language using the same brain areas as spoken language. Different sign languages exist, of course. And moving to a beat seems uniquely human.
And intention to move detected even on the same side. Plus BCIs and stimulation for stroke recovery.
Exciting research areas. And that headless chicken Mike story, grim, but shows the brainstem's vital role in basic life support without the cortex.
Okay, incredible journey. We've seen the cortex's architecture, layers, columns, topographical maps for senses, population coding for movement. It's amazing plasticity.
And how critical it is for higher awareness, perception, planning, as shown when it's damaged or absent.
So the final thought to leave you with. Given this adaptability, the blurry lines of awareness, what really defines our conscious experience?
And how much of our free will, our choices, are actually emerging from these incredibly complex cortical dances happening largely beneath our conscious notice?
You definitely have something to mull over, the balance between our perceived self and the biological machinery underneath. If you want to explore more, check out researchers like Erson or Blank, the source material, or try those illusions.
Pinocchio, rubber hand yourself.
Get a feel for your own brain's interpretations. Thanks for joining this deep dive.